Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. This is Aaron, I guess, and this is March 2024, and today I have an author on. He's an indie author for the most part. He's written for other places as well. And anything I just said, you might correct, but we'll see. And I have Frederick Garrow Heimbach on the show, and today we're going to be talking about his book, The Devil's Dictum. So Frederick, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, where you've published before and all that good stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. I'm really excited to be on the show. I've been listening for a long time.
Oh, that's good to hear.
And I've been practicing my answer to the last question on the show for months now. So
perfect.
I should be able to rattle that off. Yeah, I live in Ann Arbor, with my wife. We have two grown children. Both of us, in fact, have lived in Michigan all our lives. I started out in terms of my creative pursuits as a composer. My mother was of a fanatical musician and got me started playing the piano. But my interest, our personalities are dramatically different. So she is truly was a born performer, whereas I am more interested in the creative activity of composing. And so it took me many years to realize that I haven't really been living as a musician, and that my work as a composer was stunted because I really wasn't interested in following through to performance, which is kind of what music is really all about. This might come as a shock. I hope your listeners are sitting down as I inform them of that fact. But I started listening to the Starship Sofa podcast. It must be a good 20 years ago now, because I've been a lifelong fan of science fiction. That despite the fact that I was raised as a Christian in a fundamentalist Protestant church, I've bounced around, but I've always been, I didn't have the strong reaction to my upbringing that some people have, particularly people who are, you know, as they become more educated, more exposed to the educational establishment. So I'm sitting there reading a body of literature that is mostly hostile to my most deeply held beliefs. Well, you have the triple threat there of Asimov, Heinlein, and Clark, who are all hostile to Christianity, and also, perhaps not coincidentally, also in their various unique ways, sex perverts. Which may or may not be.
I did not know what you were going to say. Oh, man.
And Tony C. Smith, now a good friend of mine, who and his friend started the Starship Sofa, which is the conceit was that it was a show of two guys sitting on a sofa talking about science fiction. I started listening in episode 6, and then I would send them an email after every episode. And then they would start reading them. And so I sort of evolved into a third member of the show. I started doing narrations. Roundtable discussions. I became, for a short, rather bizarre period of my life, the graphic novel editor of the show. Then when Tony spun off a new podcast called Protecting Project Pulp, he appointed me the editor. So I quickly had to become an expert in Pulp Fiction. So I have that, and that has become an influence. But meanwhile, being a fan of this science fiction podcast, I wrote a story where Tony was the main character, and it was a science fiction story, all in fun. And that got me started on writing fiction. So I've been doing that for, 15 years now or something. And honestly, I think I've seen, I just received more positive feedback from those efforts. You know, you and I, before the show, were talking about the story Fingers, which was run in Starship Sofa, but was originally published in Analog, which is probably my highest profile publication. But other magazines as well. There's a Christian speculative fiction outlet called Mysterion. If you go to Mysterion online, you'll find several of my stories published there. They pay really well. And your audience, if they don't know about Mysterion, they should really be checking that out. There's an extreme overlap of what you are interested in and what kind of fiction they're promoting. Silence and Star Song is another Christian science speculative fiction magazine, which is going to publish my second story for them coming up in a few weeks. And a few other places I've been published in. So, but I have I've self-published through Kindle Direct 3 novels, and The Devil's Dictum is my first novel.
Excellent. With your upbringing in a fundamentalist Christian household, I was raised in a nominal Catholic household. So not very strict. Did you have any pushback from your family about science fiction or anything like that? Or were they kind of
cool with it? No, it's when I went off to school and joined a charismatic Bible study, that was really... Or when I announced in my 40s that I no longer considered myself a teetotaler. those were the two times where my parents were seriously,
concerned.
Should we have Fred institutionalized? But the church I grew up in was Plymouth Brethren, and for a number of reasons, if you grow up in a church that's really pushing the King James translation of the Bible, not that they ever would have said that it was, God's chosen translation or something, which some groups do,
yes,
or used to. But, if you're reading the King James, that's not ninth grade reading level that you get, or probably more like sixth grade nowadays with the NIV, for example. If you're reading about the superfluity of naughtiness or other things, a phrase which I inserted into Devil's Dictum, by the way, a William Bradford diary, I was absolutely thrilled when I was able to work superfluity of naughtiness into it. But there's some real intellectual rigor if you're going to be reading the Bible from the King James translation. If you are listening to people who have who have arguments against evolution, or take a very literal approach to the Genesis flood, those people can usually run rings around their debate opponents, it is a mistake. Well, it is certainly, let me put it this way, not my experience that fundamentalists are ignorant. They almost suffer from too much erudition in a certain way, because they are the group that I'm familiar with, were born debaters. They've got talking points a mile long, and they can out talk you. You want to be careful when you go up against them.
That's kind of my experience too, a little bit, is that they have an answer to everything, right? It's their whole, it's well thought out, It's very well thought out, and it's they're not ignorant people by any stretch. You know, it's it actually is kind of dangerous to debate them.
They think of themselves as the supreme bulwark against the Enlightenment, but they've kind of, to me, the best argument against fundamentalism is that they sort of accept some of the scientism assumptions of the Enlightenment, and then try to beat the Enlightenment at its own game.
That's their biggest flaw. Yeah, they take certain arguments. They take certain arguments from the atheist Enlightenment people, you know, like the new atheists and stuff, and they try to just basically put a Christian spin on it and hand it back to them, and it doesn't really work, you know. And so anyway. So your first book was The Devil's Dictum. So why don't you tell us what that book is, like who the main characters are, you know, where does it take place, and what kind of, I don't know if you like the term genre. I'm kind of genre to me, after, you know, being a, like, here's my obligatory Tim Powers reference. After reading Tim Powers, after reading like Gene Wolfe and stuff like that, genre, those guys don't, especially Tim Powers, he doesn't really work in like normal genres. You know, he kind of just does whatever he wants. And so just kind of tell us what kind of book is it?
It is an alternate history, but I really want your listeners to take what I just said and erase that from their memories, because so much of alternate history is a very rigorous attempt to, often just one little fact will be changed, and then the book becomes an argument, a very deeply researched argument for exactly how history would have played out if you know, General X hadn't died on the eve of this great battle or something, and what if he had lived, or, you know, or what if the king of Greece hadn't been bitten on the hand by his pet monkey and he had died just before the, you know, great war against Turkey, or what, however that famous quote from Winston Churchill, that one's an actual example, but because my problem is I am not interested in rigor at all. To me, alternate history is an excuse to indulge in all, you know, these preposterous flights of fancy. So I got a great review early on after the book came out, and this person's describing the book, and then these alternate history fans show up in the comments and they say, wait, you're saying, you know, the timelines diverge in 1620, and yet in the 20th century, Richard Nixon is still somehow born, and he's launching attack against Washington, D.C., piloting a giant robot. You know, no, that would never happen. That would never happen. That's ridiculous. And my response is, yeah, it's ridiculous. I know it's ridiculous. Stop thinking, just turn off your mind. So this is very odd alternate history, and at some point I removed the book from that categorization in Amazon. You know, Amazon's genre categorization system is incredibly vexing for many reasons anyway, and so I just stopped calling it an alternate history, because I don't want to pull some kind of stupid bait switch and then have these angry hardcore alternate history fans, you know, giving me 2-star reviews. Mm-hmm. 2-star reviews are the best, by the way. The 1-stars are mostly idiots, but the 2-star people, they have a certain self-awareness, and it's a sign of a certain, you know, intelligence or self-possession. Now that I think of it, I'm not sure I've ever written a 2-star. I did give Henry James The Turn of a Screw a 1-star review, though, and I am not sorry, but that's a whole story. So if you read my book, the timeline from our world diverges at 1620, but you have the action takes place in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of famous people show up in the book. Calvin Coolidge and, Tip O'Neill.
Yes.
And as I mentioned, Ronald, I shouldn't have said that, should I? we discussed whether we were even going to spoil that. But anyway, Richard Nixon. In fact, every named character in the book is a historical character, mm-hmm. although some of them are extremely obscure. So you just have to roll with that and accept it, that somehow these people are getting born, even though the entire history of the United States is completely different. And we can get into that.
Mm-hmm.
There are really two themes that I'm exploring, two ideas. And the first one comes from my fundamentalist upbringing. It's this claim that gets repeated, got repeated a number of times in my church, which is that we all, and Haiti is in the news right now, so it's just going through another one of its horrifying, tragic upheavals
mm-hmm.
as we speak. So the idea, the claim is that Haiti is dysfunctional and this nightmare of a country because soon after its revolution, its founders formally dedicated the country to Satan.
Hmm.
And I don't know if you've ever heard that, but
I have, yeah. I don't really, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's supposedly enshrined in their original constitution. And it's very interesting. Back in before Twitter and Google ruined the blogosphere, I was reading a blog by a Canadian journalist called Colby Kosh. He was really interesting. A religious skeptic, but I really enjoyed reading him because he was very honest, you know, would follow the evidence, and he would sometimes pick on Christians, but more often he was skewering the pieties and the unspoken assumptions of the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And he's Canadian, so that, you probably sense my anti-Canadian bias as you're reading the novel. It's not subtle. So, and one day I'm reading Colby Kosh, and I hadn't thought about this Haiti thing for years, and he's writing and says, yeah, I understand among evangelical Christians, they have this idea that Haiti is the way it is because they dedicated their country to Satan, you know, whatever it was, 300 years ago or something. And he said, so I looked into it, and by golly, it's kind of more or less true. And so I thought, wow, okay, well, if Colby Kosh says it's true, then I think that there must be something to it. So, and then the other theme of the book is questioning the idea that the United States is successful because our founding fathers had read history so carefully, and they carefully devised a system of checks and balances and got the balance just perfect. So whether it's the federal system balancing the federal government against the states, or whether it's the three branches of government all balancing, and they just nailed it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that experiment has been run in other countries, because Brazil has had a constitution after they got their independence, and apparently other Latin American countries, more than one, were really impressed by the success of the United States, so they decided to set up similar constitutions structured the same way. And it didn't work out so well. And then you have going, you know, if you want to appeal to the founding fathers, you go back to John Adams. He has that famous quote. He said, our government was designed for a religious people, and it will not work with any other. Paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think John Adams is right. And I think as we see our country now sliding into increasing decadence, where we've lost our ability, you know, there are good, wise, sober, capable people still around in our country. It's just that our system doesn't let them get anywhere near the levers of power anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just astonishing. And of course the tribalism, you know, blah blah blah. My book was reviewed as though it was describing the political landscape we're in now, but honestly, I wrote, you know, I outlined this book, I think, all the way back in 2014. You know, mm-hmm. Donald Trump ascended the escalator, and nobody thought that we would have a, you know, 87-year-old, you know, potentially looking at an 87-year-old president or any of that kind of stuff. And but decadence is definitely on my mind. And so in the Devil's Dictum, the United States of America, the Satanic Republic of the United States of America, apparently has a constitution where they've got separation of powers, and they've got a federal system, and, you know, and all down to the detail where only a natural born citizen of the United States could be president, you know, or vice president. And so, of course, the, you know, even Obama, late in the Obama presidency, when his birth certificate was this big vexing issue for 15 minutes, you know, and so I even anticipated that, but there was no talk of Obama's birth certificate when I wrote this book. What is the plot? Okay, so the backstory is, in 1620, the Pilgrims arrive on the Mayflower at the coast of Massachusetts, but they can't land and found the Plymouth Colony because there's a ship full of Satan-worshipping pirates that had got there first. So they are essentially chased out of there, and by a process not really explained, they end up all the way down in Haiti before they make landfall. And so the Republic founded by the Pilgrims is in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And this Republic, which is dedicated to Satan, is founded in Massachusetts and is called the United States of America. It's the United States of America versus the Republic of Haiti. But everything, it's a topsy-turvy world. And the Church of Satan is the state religion of the United States of America. Now, fast forward to the 1940s. And for complex reasons, all the women have disappeared from the United States of America. It's a country only of men. Therefore, nobody's being born in that country. Therefore, nobody can be legally elected president. So they're using the mechanism in the Constitution where if those offices are vacated, then the Speaker of the House becomes president.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that the system as it operates practically is a dictatorship by the Chief Justice of the United States. So the Chief Justice has locked up all the members of the House of Representatives are locked up in Congress. And because they're imprisoned there, they've gone mad. This, by the way, is inspired by a historical event from the Ottoman Empire. Late in the Ottoman Empire, the sultans got in the habit of murdering all their brothers. And of course, with polygamy, they would often have dozens of or scores of brothers, and just to secure their own position, they would murder their brothers as soon as they took the throne. So one of these sultans, their mother begged the son not to do that, so he decided to lock them all up in a mansion, and then literally, you know, just shoveling food in for them, and they could never come out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sultan died without an heir, so they broke into the house to find the next oldest brother, and the man had gone completely mad. He was nuttier than a fruitcake. And so now you have a string of presidents who are pulled out of the House of Representatives but they're complete lunatics.
Mm-hmm.
And but if they cause the Chief Justice any trouble at all, then the Chief Justice sends his personal assassin to get rid of them. And that brings us to the main character of the book. His title is Special Master, which is one of these archaic titles that the United States has inherited. The U.S. justice system has inherited, I suppose, from England, which is another one of these goofy oddities from history that amuse me. So I stuck it in the novel, right? So the Special Master, all of his adult life, he's served the Chief Justice, and the Chief Justice is a drunk and is in steep decline in his later years. So the Special Master is pretty much the conciliaire or the prime minister. He's the fixer for the, whenever the Chief Justice wants something to happen, the Special Master figures out how to get it done. So he's an incredibly important person. And he has the, like many of these kids who grew up in the United States, and how they end up in the United States, since there are no women to birth them, is a bit of a something that gets revealed through the course of the novel. But he doesn't know his birth name. So that's really the mystery of the book. Who is this person? And if you realize that every named character is a person from history, then you can be sure that once he's named, you'll know who he is. But this is revealed at the end, but it's only one of two big secrets, and probably people who are fans of, you know, are students of history will figure it out halfway through. So you shouldn't feel too bad if you do figure it out. You said though that you didn't know till the end of the book what his identity was.
Right. I didn't, when it was revealed, then I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Because his notable absence throughout the book, because you have a bunch of other named, you know, historical figures, like you mentioned Richard Nixon and other people like that, other U.S. presidents I didn't notice his absence
Warren
until
Harding.
Yeah, right. I didn't notice his absence, or you know, not really absence. I didn't notice it until he was revealed. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's where he was the whole time.
Yeah.
All right.
So we won't worry too much about that spoiler. But the inciting event of the book is that the Chief Justice announces a new job, and he actually, the other members of the Supreme Court typically just rubber stamp his decisions, but he calls them in and he wants them to help him achieve an important goal. The top priority of his government becomes rounding up all the men in the country that fit a certain description, and the Special Master is not being asked to help out on doing this job, and so he becomes very suspicious. Then he reads the description and he realizes that it's a description of himself.
Mm-hmm.
So for some bizarre reason, the Chief Justice wants every person that looks a lot like the Special Master, his right-hand man, rounded up and murdered. And so the Special Master is sent away on a fool's errand. For some bizarre reason, the Chief Justice wants him just completely out of the picture. And so the Special Master uses this time away to, he goes off on his own and proceeds to solve the mystery of who are these people. And it will come as, yeah. Oh, well, I guess I don't want to say any more, but it's essentially a mystery. And, you know, there's, I just have an enormous amount of fun. You know, each chapter is interspersed with a little, like, it's called, they're little fact bulletins, you might call them.
Yes.
And so the first one is like a paper, if I remember correctly, it's the paper placemat from a restaurant. And it lists Is that one the one that lists the presidents of the United States or the high priests of the Church of Satan? But
I think it's the presidents. I think that's the first one that's listed.
Yeah. The first one, yeah.
Yep.
And so it's like, you know, James Buchanan, our greatest president, you know, but some James Bowie, who died when he fell on a kitchen knife, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte III. Is President Andrew Johnson and James Buchanan, some of our more successful presidents. The father of our country is, of course, Aaron Burr, who wasn't elected the first president. Of course, that was Alexander Hamilton, but Aaron Burr, you know, killed him in a duel and then became the first president. So everything is, you know.
My favorite was...
Yeah,
my favorite was Edgar Allan Poe as the president.
Yes,
his one tumultuous year in office saw the failure of the Poe Act, which would have lowered the legal age of marriage to 12, and the crash of a hot air balloon intended to reach the moon. Scandals led to his murder and that of his vice president at the hands of a mob. And then you later describe that he did one good thing, and he composed the national anthem.
Yes. Yes, and the singing of the national anthem occupies the entire chapter.
Yes,
So this is the this is the alternate history timeline where Edgar Allan Poe actually had talent.
Oh snap! We get hate mail from Edgar Allan Poe fans.
So I'll be probably murdered by a mob for saying that. But, everything is designed to maximize the perversity, right? And to turn everything upside down. Mm-hmm. So by the time you get to the 1940s, the Church of Satan is in steep decline, and they're really worried because the young people are not coming to church anymore.
That's right.
And so there's a scene where the special master flashes back to his childhood, where for reasons of his own, he decides to the local priest of the Church of Satan shows up and is handing out these pathetic little flyers where, yeah, you could become a priest in the Church of Satan, or you could become a worship leader, or you could
youth director or something like that.
Youth director.
I laughed very hard at that.
Yeah,
like
that was extreme. You know, that wrote itself, that little flyer. Yeah, you know, Uncle Satan wants you.
Right.
And he shows up to this church for one of these youth meetings for reasons of his own. And it turns out the youth, the youth center in the church is just a single dusty ping pong table inside a little room in the basement.
It's like one paddle. Yeah. It's like one paddle or something.
Oh, yeah, one paddle. And you know, no one under the age of 50 has darkened the door of that church in years. You know?
Right.
And so everything is meant to be upside down and backwards.
Yeah, one nice detail I liked about the describing the church service and stuff is like the gargoyles are all on the inside of the church, and the saints, like all the images of the saints, are like the places, and the gargoyles on the outside of the church. You know?
I forgot about that.
Yes, that was a nice detail. I liked that. It was funny.
Well, yeah, one of the jobs that you can apply for if you want a career in the church is Saint Finder General.
Yes. Right. I don't know if you ever described what that was, but I'm like, because I think at the very beginning, you're just kind of listing off the different positions in the church, you know, like Saint Finder General. What is it, like a almost like a witch hunter, you know, or something?
Yeah. Well, a witch hunter general or a witch finder.
Yeah.
There really were in the Puritans. Had
yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Right. Was Solomon Cain the Robert E. Howard character, was he one of those, or was he?
I don't know if he was specifically. I mean, he might have been. My Robert E. Howard knowledge is limited.
It was a Hammer horror movie about a witch finder general, if I'm not mistaken. And I shouldn't be saying these because these are all half baked memories lodged in my brain. So take nothing I say seriously. That's always a good rule to follow.
So, yeah. So it's a, like, a lot of it is very funny. Like, it's very, very funny. Very, I kind of called it kitchen sink Satanism, where everything was kind of like
right.
thrown in there, like the tritones, you know, like when they're doing the meeting at the, it was the Senate building, right? So they
cathedral or, oh no, 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 no. Yeah. The,
all the senators show
up.
The
meeting of the electors.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, thank you. And like, oh, there's a tritone, you know. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And there's other things like that, you know, where it's just every trope, every goofy thing that, you know, anyone's ever
right.
said about, you know, anything satanic is just thrown in there.
Right.
And some of it is.
I don't know if you were uncomfortable. Like, is worshiping Satan funny? And of course, in many ways, it is not.
No,
it's pathetic. It's perverse. It's disgusting. But of course, the problem that Satanists have struggled with for a long time is that you are Satanism if you take the approach that, oh yeah, we're taking these characters from the Christian Bible. It's just that the villain is the hero and the hero is the villain.
Right.
Well, that's an incredibly derivative, reactionary religion. You're the Christians are living in your head, you know,
right.
rent free.
Well, what they would do too, like in real life, they'll take Christian symbols and like, you know, claim them for their own, right? So like the upside down cross. And like, you know, right. or the pentagram. Well, all of those symbols have Christian origins. So like the upside down cross is St. Peter, right? And then the pentagram actually is the five wounds of Christ, right? So like that in the Middle Ages, that was what they used to depict like the five wounds of Christ or the five virtues of a knight, you know, all in perfect balance. And Satanists, what usually happens is...
a five-pointed star, it's not... It's a little bit like the swastika. People keep reinventing it. And,
right. It's like they take the symbol and you use it for your own purpose, right? So you're...
Right.
It's like they didn't come up with the symbol. They didn't, you know, it's the symbol was already there and they repurpose it for their own being, you know, their own stuff. It happened with like the occultists and the, you know, like the Wiccans, whatever. You know, they say, oh, we're hundreds and hundreds of years old. It's like, no, you were invented less than 100 years ago.
it's really a LARP.
Yeah.
The disease of, you know.
That's what makes it sad. That's what makes it ultimately sad. And it isn't like a joke. Obviously, like, if you even mockingly in real life worship Satan, he doesn't care. He'll use it, right?
You do not want to open that door.
No.
And you don't want to pretend to open the door or open it and shut it real fast. No, don't open that door. No, I take that stuff incredibly seriously. And I think that, I don't know if you follow Owen Cyclops
on
Twitter, but mm-hmm. boy, his and some of these people, if you approach it very, you know, in a state of extreme ignorance and naivete, you will sometimes be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And he survived and emerged as a fantastic Christian witness.
Yeah.
But he experimented with drugs and encountered the beings and, you know, there's one story, I think it might've been, magic brownies. So just marijuana, which is considered to be fairly tame, but it can induce psychosis or bizarre trips
in
certain people. And this one person was given, I believe this was the story, a person was given one of these and just so he consumed it in complete innocence, and he encountered an ominous, no, he encountered, it was essentially a guardian angel appeared, a kind of warrior spirit. And he said, you know, I know that you have arrived at this place by accident, not by your own fault. So I'm going to protect you, and we're going to send you back, and you're going to be fine. But if you ever come back here again, you're on your own.
Oh boy, yeah, wow.
And that, you know, that if that does not raise the hairs on the back of your neck, then you are just not thinking. You're not treating it seriously.
Well, I always thought like when you engage in that sort of stuff, like psychedelic drugs or like the occult, it's like you're going into a foreign country without your proper paperwork in order, you know. And then you're you know, waylaid by marauders and they throw you in prison and nobody knows you're there, you know, and you don't have, nobody right. cares, like you don't have your right paperwork and so you can't get out through the legal system, right? So it's like God gave us certain means to access the spiritual world through prayer and fasting and almsgiving and stuff, through self-mortification and humility. And like the occult is like cheating. You know, it's like you're taking the easy way in, you know, and that's where all the monsters are, and they're waiting for you. So it's
cheating, and you are trying to make get an advantage over other people.
So it's usually self-interest and getting power.
There is typically an arrogance at the heart, and I think that arrogant approach to spirituality versus the humility that you mentioned is just absolutely critical. To why, how, I mean, if you listen to Jonathan Peugeot, he claims that even people will adopt some of the spiritual practices of Eastern Orthodoxy. And he says, but if they don't have spiritual directors, they can, he said there are examples where people have even descended into madness, and you have to suspect that there was some kind of pride at the heart of that, not seeking a spiritual director. And again, you know, the saints will tell you that their miracles are absolutely the least interesting thing about what God is doing in their lives and the lives of other people.
Right.
And the craving for the miraculous, which I confess to, I admit it.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be a saint, and, you know, command the mountain to be removed, but that's a bit of spiritual immaturity on my part that I have to acknowledge.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and pride is at the heart of the fall, right? So, and
absolutely.
So, you know, the devil will take any opportunity to get you. And I remember there's one like a couple years ago. I'm like, finally kick this bad habit, this sinful thing, and finally, you know, yeah, right. I'm like, I finally did it. You know, I'm done. I'm good. And then like, what, a week later, I'm back at confession for the same darn thing, you know? And it was like, as soon as I, you know, indulged in the sinful thing or whatever, I'm like, yeah, remember when you said that? That was fun. That was a funny joke you said. And I'm like, okay, now when I'm like, okay, I finally passed this. I remember like, okay, it's not because of me. You know, it's because God is merciful and good. And he's helping me every step of the way.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, it'd be funny if it weren't so tragic, but it's, I think, I'm just, you know, kind of wondering, so not to put you on the spot, but in the book, what kind of made me a little uncomfortable was, the characters, instead of saying like, invoking God, they invoke Satan, right? Like in the same way that like normal people would do that. Was that when you were doing that, I get why you did it, right? Cause it is supposed to be kind of ridiculous. But was that like a
world?
Was that kind of a concern, like, you know, that you would like accidentally, I don't think it's as easy as like accidentally invoking Satan, you know, you know what I mean?
Because I love swearing I have something I was thinking about lately is I will include swearing and even fairly obscene terms sometimes in my fiction, but I have never used the name of the Lord in vain.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have characters say, "Oh God," that is a little bit different. Well, yeah, I guess I do draw the line at the Lord's name.
Yeah.
You know, would I do that now? I'm not so sure because I am a little uncomfortable, you know, 8 years later, the philosophical incoherence of the Satanists. is amusing to me,
yes.
And I was poking fun of that.
Oh, I get why you, I get why you did it. Yeah. From a story standpoint. Yep.
Yeah, but I think to have the characters say that, it makes no sense, and it would never happen, and there would never be a society. You know, society like that would self-destruct.
Well, that was another point I wanted to talk about, was just the sheer self-contradictoriness of like anarchist satanic pirates founding a republic, you know, and like how there's all these crazy, like really minuscule rules, but you know, it's just complete chaos. I guess that's how it would work out, right? So it's like
You really have to turn off your brain and just let it flow.
Yes.
I get frustrated with other authors who make that demand, you know. I think you were the one who invited me into that Gene Wolfe discussion group that we have on Twitter.
I'm happy you're in the group, but I don't think it was me.
Okay. I don't remember who did that. Maybe, yeah. But I do find him frustrating because he just never explains anything. And I've wanted really bad, you know, as a thoughtful Catholic author working in science fiction, you know, devout Christian, you've got your Gene Wolfe, you've got your Tim Powers, you've got your C.S. Lewis space trilogy. Some people are, you know, what's his name? A.F. Lafferty. And then you're getting into the more
Lafferty,
obscure.
Yeah.
A few others, and then things are getting pretty obscure. So I really, really wanted badly to fall in love with Gene Wolfe's writing. But and some of it all of it is great in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man was a fantastic stylist.
Yeah.
And some of them are great comprehensively, but man, some of that stuff, it's like, what the heck? And then somebody explains it to you, and you're like, sorry, I'm still confused. I can think of six reasons why your explanation doesn't even make sense. And then they'll say, oh, yeah, well, you know, everything's ambiguous. And it's like, yeah, I'm just not into that. So nothing in my book is ambiguous.
Right.
It's not that kind of turn off your brain and let it flow. And it has a plot, you know. Several of my reviewers on Amazon, if you go there, you'll see them say, yeah, he just keeps introducing more and more weird stuff, but don't worry, it all comes together in the end. So I do tie up the loose thread.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
At the very end. Right. So there is a plot. It's just that, the backstory in the scenario is preposterous. That's part of it is a complete farce.
Well, it's a lot of fun. Like, there's a lot of really laugh out loud funny moments and a lot of like gross out kind of humor too. There's one scene where, you know, the special master, he's doing an autopsy, and he, in order to distract the clerk that was supposed to be keeping an eye on him, he like pops an eyeball out of the corpse, you know, and has it roll under the bed. And he's like, could you get that for me, please? You know, it's like, oh, it's so gross, but it's really funny. Like it's just this absurd sort of, you know, grotesque humor that there's like,
that's Chief Justice William O. Douglas, isn't it? Who's being autopsied. And
yes.
He died very suspiciously, which is pretty much the way everyone dies in the United States of America. But earlier he's in a diner and he's eating some French fries and he dips them in ketchup. And of course he has wooden teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, that's so
gross.
When
he bites into the French fry, the ketchup squirts out between his wooden teeth. And yeah, there's a lot of that. I'm not sure I would do that again, but it was kind of fun to write it.
Yeah, it fits. You know? Like, when it all kind of fit, you know? But yeah, there was like, oh, it's so, like, just visceral, it's nasty. But, like, you can't help but laugh because it's so gross, you know? there's other stuff like that, too. Like, in the House of Representatives, and everyone's crazy, you know, it's like they're floating down on the river of sewage, like human excrement and stuff like that. And they even mentioned, like, you know, if Dante wasn't banned, you know, they would have recognized this was straight out of Dante, you know. Dante's considered enemy propaganda, right? So
a field environment, when someone is elected to the House of Representatives, they're sent in the indoor, they can't get out there. And then when they want the new president to be pulled out, there's another door that can only be opened a certain way, so to allow one person out at a time.
Right.
So there's only four things that are allowed, four material things that can go into the House of Representatives, and they're food, water, parchment and ink.
Right, for drafting laws.
And there's only three things that come out: urine, feces, and legislation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Otherwise, it's a closed system.
Yes. yeah, that was a bit claustrophobic, that scene when he's in there, you know. So another question I had was, is this written from a certain literary framework? Because some of it is historical, like it's like you have your point of facts where it's like, you know, you're describing the different presidents, or like you have Nixon's secret autobiography written on his underwear, you know, or whatever it was.
Prison issued underwear, yes.
Yeah. And other things like that. Is this written from a specific perspective or what?
It came from my brain. I don't know how to answer that question otherwise, unless you can narrow it down.
Well, like, you know, Dracula is epistolary, right? So, you have the phrase, in the first paragraph, the chief justice likes his president's crazy, but not too crazy. The current president was too crazy. The chief wanted him dead, so the special master had to kill him. That was how things worked in the year of their Lord, 1946. Oh, yeah. And so I'm like, well, their Lord, you know, is this written from like Nixon's perspective
because all the horrible people are drawn to the United States, that means all the other countries are far better off materially, spiritually. There was no French Revolution. There was no Russian Revolution. Both those countries still have Christian monarchs.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very much the idea is it's the United States against the world. So they picked up this term, Year of Our Lord.
Yeah.
And because they're derivative and they're, you know, the Christian church is completely living rent-free in their head. They have to use the term Year of Their Lord. It's not one of the more clever devices in the book, I admit, but that's the reason for it.
Gotcha,
Haiti becomes this fabulously wealthy, you know, they developed the atomic bomb like 40 years earlier in this timeline because they're so technologically advanced and, you know, the capital, Port of Washington is the capital of Haiti, and it has all these skyscrapers that are like 150, 200, whatever. I don't remember. You know, it's just a picture of incredibly wealthy, incredibly successful, incredibly well-ordered and well-governed country. And they keep having, because they're so devout, they keep having great awakenings.
Oh, yeah.
So, Richard Nixon at the end of the book ends up leading the 17th Great Awakening or something during the presidency of Billy Graham.
Right,
During President Billy Graham's administration. So there you go, one more inversion just because the book didn't have enough.
Yeah, I didn't realize that there were. That the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution didn't happen. That is interesting. So it's like all the bad people go to the United States. And yeah, it's just funny because, like, you know, there are, you know, the idea that the United States, and this is largely-ish true, kind of, you know, true-ish, like they're Freemasons founded the United States and they're like a secret satanic cult, you know, and like, you know, it's true enough, I suppose, with like, there are different members of the Founding Fathers were Freemasons, some weren't, you know, some were very against Freemasonry, so it's kind of a mixed bag, right? But it's, but yeah, there already kind of is that idea of like America as
in fact
satanic.
You probably didn't recognize all these things that the guy who put the I on the back of the dollar bill is in the book, and I think he's one of the presidents. Although maybe he's one of the high priests of the Church of Satan, but he made it on one of those lists.
Well, I saw Aleister. You know, Aleister Crowley is the high priest. I saw that. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. He would be. He probably would want that, you know.
Right.
And other people too. There some people I was like, you had Nixon as in Haiti, like they were the good guys, you know, the Christian. Right. And I thought that was interesting. And then you had
this is some The one thing that Haiti can't do that they want desperately to do is to invade the United States of America and defeat them and subjugate them and impose their order on that cesspool of a country. But of course, this is now the guns, germs, and steel hypothesis. But every time, it's happened 6 times in history that a Haitian army has landed in the United States and they get wiped out by diseases. Right. They're never able to repel these invasions by any military skill whatsoever.
But right.
The diseases always wipe them out.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice touch too, because the United States is so disorganized that they don't, you know, they have no way to repel an army, but that is like the sheer amount of just disgusting, you know, disease and stuff is what keeps them from being conquered.
Fighting wars with Canada as well. And Canada's problem is that the Canadian army does not bear arms.
Right. Yeah.
So they keep fighting to a draw at the Canadian, the northern border keeps shifting. Yeah.
Yes, that was, yeah, there's a lot of
they
funny
die
stuff.
Bravely, the Canadians are very brave. They just don't happen to carry guns.
Well, I think you had a line where they said their retreats were always very orderly and dignified or something like that. they're so beautiful retreating, you know, because they're so regimented and they're all like galloping. Right. I don't think they have horses either. They're all just like kind of like quasi galloping, like a Monty Python style
like
away.
Yeah. You know? Yes, something. They're not clumping coconut shells together like they did in Monty Python. I guess that joke was already taken.
Well, yeah. So one thing, so I did look up a little bit about like what a special master does, right? And
right.
And he does tend to handle, you know, it's a title given to, I think, an attorney they do handle like special cases for the judge, right? So that, you know, that is largely true.
Appointed by a judge.
Right.
Perform a special action that the judiciary typically cannot do. So, for example, if a judge says, for example, that conditions in a prison need to be improved, mm-hmm. you know, inciting the, you know, Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. Well, you can't have the warden of the jail carry out that order. So typically in that situation, a special master will be put in charge of the jail temporarily until the changes are made.
Mm.
So it's a kind of an executive function under the supervision of a judge. But also a quirk in our timeline's constitution is that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has original jurisdiction. I think it's for treaty cases, or maybe it's when one state sues another. There's a few cases where it doesn't percolate up through the system, federal, appellate, and then Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court is supposed to be the original court to hear the case. Well, they don't dirty their hands with conducting a trial. They would never listen to witnesses or rule on evidence. So the Chief Justice will appoint a special master in that case to sit as the trial judge, after which then the Supreme Court will rule will either accept or reject his recommendations. So those are two examples of a special master in action.
Yeah, and there's another one too that I didn't do very much looking into this, but they also will do some research into any scientific matters, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and so I thought that fit the theme of the book.
Case, expert testimony is going to be entered in
something like that. Yeah, or they have to research this scientific, you know, do some scientific research or something. And that would actually fit the theme of the book pretty well, because one of the questions is, where do babies come from? Right. So,
which the Chief Justice does not understand.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Which I also thought was very funny. I won't spoil it, but
he's never met a woman. And, these kids arrive in the United States very young. And so they have very little memory of their past lives.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and then another line was, you know, I can't remember the context, but the Chief Justice is like, well, we are a nation of immigrants, you know?
Yeah,
Which.
that's a piety of our
Yeah. But just the context that he's
culture, and
talking
not
about in
just
the book, you know, how
stabbing
they
the
get the
people, but
immigrants, you know, it's like.
yeah, that's one word for
Yeah, it's like that's a good phrase, you know, it's I guess that makes sense.
these very young boys are when they're dragged ashore screaming in terror.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, we are a nation of immigrants after all. It's like, okay. Oh man.
I'm glad you liked it, because that is kind of sick humor, actually. That actually offends me almost more than the bathroom humor, or joking around with the Church of Satan.
Right. Well, one thing about,
So,
so like Tim, you know, going back to Tim Powers, I know you are a fan of his as well, but he,
absolutely, yes.
yeah, he does this thing about, you know, the Lord's name in vain, that sort of thing. His characters will say, but often it actually does something, right? So
Oh, so it's
in,
not in vain, in fact.
right,
All
exactly.
whatever their intent is, it does not return void. Yes.
Right. It actually does do something. Like I was just rereading Declare. I'm trying to finish up another an essay, the other half of my essay on it, for my
Yeah.
Substack. And it's an incredible book, but there's this one scene where Kim Philby, they're about to go up to Mount Ararat, you know, and he says Jesus, right? He says the name Jesus, and he means it as a like a profanity or a blasphemy or whatever.
Expletive, yeah.
Yeah, and Mammalian, the other character, he's like, it would be best, you know, prayer is counterindicative, you know. So he's like you shouldn't say that here because where we're
Right.
going, these creatures don't really like Jesus. So, you know, it's
Yes.
like, so it's even Tim Powers has this thing where even like when the characters do that, it isn't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have an effect, right? So it's.
There is no thoughtless word, and certainly no thoughtless sentence in any of Tim Power's novels, that's for sure.
Well, and then comparing him to Gene Wolfe, I know what you mean about the, I think Gene Wolfe is an amazing author, but I do think his ambiguity, his deliberate ambiguity, kind of like, it makes it hard to like him, you know, if you aren't used to him, and it's like,
Right.
Tim Powers, I always feel the need to dive more deeply into his stories because they're just there's
You
something
feel
about
like
it. Yeah, go
he
ahead.
will reward
Yeah.
the extra effort.
Gene Wolfe, I'm like, he will, but it's like, it's almost too obscure, like some of it. Like some of it's really good. Like
Some of it is.
I love
Some of it is, and some of it isn't. Yeah.
yeah. Like I it's all well written and entertaining, but you end a short story, you're like, what was the point of that? You know, like I don't understand. And then you look
Well.
and I'm very grateful for people like Mark Aramini and people like that who take the time to actually try to decipher them because I do think there is a puzzle to be solved. But I don't always feel the desire to do that with Gene Wolfe stories like I do with other people's, like Tim Powers. Now, sometimes I feel
Yeah.
Tim Powers is too obvious, you know, when he's explaining too much, you know, but
Well,
hey,
some of
whatever.
that is obscure. Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's just my personal
I will
opinion, I
tell you
guess.
that my wife and I were on a drive a few months ago, so I asked her to listen with me your episode on Gene Wolfe
Oh, okay, yeah.
of I Might Believe in Fairies. And you're going into some of the very disturbing themes, and quite honestly, the particularly when he is depicting, it's always extremely indirectly because almost everything he does is indirect, but
Right.
depicting child abuse
Yeah, right.
and these some of these sexual themes, and it does concern me.
Yeah.
And when we were done listening, my wife said, "You like him?"
Yeah, I
Oh gosh,
mean,
and then
that's
I had to
another thing
explain,
too. It's he does touch on disturbing things in his books.
right,
Yeah.
and there's even like child nudity in there, and I have to, I would not do that,
Yeah.
okay? And
Right.
obviously there are things in the Devil's Dictum that are perhaps too flippant, which you could object to, and I truly would not probably not choose to write a book like this again. But, you know, I'm older and wiser and more stodgy. And, you know, that was my first novel. So I guess I'm willing to cut myself some slack there. And you know, some of it, there's times when I will recall a scene or a line from the book just out of the blue, you know, some random moment, and I'll just start laughing. So
yes, it is very funny.
That's a little self-indulgent. But Tim Powers, yeah, I really admire what he's doing with his secret history. So that the idea is that he's writing, introducing magical and science fictional elements, but like he's done the research, so you cannot prove that anything that happens in one of his alternate histories did not happen exactly the way he described it. So
right. That's,
he insists they're not alternate histories, they're secret histories, right? I just don't think, now there are two really interesting topics that I've been toying with, and I've been thinking, should I try to pull a Tim Powers with one of these things? And I'll just mention them. I'm not sure if it's going to, the research is going to pan out, but one of them is the life of Jack Parsons. I don't know if you've ever heard
yeah.
of him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a co-founder of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and it was really responsible for turning rocketry from this laughing stock into, oh, wait, you know, all of these sci-fi dreams of going to the moon, maybe we actually could do it. So he's a really remarkable person. Guy, you know, blew himself up in one of his experiments. But he was also I described him in one forum as a Crowleyite Satanist.
Yeah.
And immediately someone came back rather snippy. Thelema is not Satanism. Thelema is the name of Aleister Crowley's religion. And
mm-hmm.
So it immediately, you know, so I just defended myself. Well, if Jack Parsons didn't want to be called a Satanist, he probably should not have invoked Satan in a little ceremony in his bedroom when he was, I don't know, 10 years old or whatever it was, you know, which with were results. He never described exactly what happened, but something happened.
Oh boy.
And then he joined the, the Order of the, getting all these various occult groups mixed up, but he joined the Crowley cult coven in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and was a leader and performed, you know, Enochian magic,
right?
And and all of this where sex acts are introduced into the religious rites, and that's when you really know that the Nephilim are going to be come knocking on your door any minute, you know.
Yep.
And he was doing all that, so I didn't back down at all. And then the other thing is, just because Aleister Crowley said at various times and places, no, I'm not a Satanist, of course, not a preposterous, you know, it's like laughing at the silly fundamentalists who are, actually, when you dig deep, you can find examples where Aleister Crowley acknowledged that he was engaging in Satanism at various
right.
times. So I think it's almost the midwit meme at play where, you know, the naive people say, oh, Aleister Crowley, he worshipped Satan, didn't he? And then the midwit is got this long, you know,
explanation. Yeah.
A long explanation of why. And then the genius is, wow, Aleister Crowley was, worshiping Satan, wasn't he? You know, and so that's the way I felt. That's the way I feel about Aleister Crowley. But,
I agree.
So Jack Parsons is one, but I don't have a plot yet at all. And then the other one is these fascinating airship sightings in 1896 and 1897. I don't know if you've ever heard of those, but there was a series of dozens of sightings starting in California, then working their way east across the United States and ending up, I think, all the way into New York and Ontario. But and it has all the hallmarks of UFO sightings, mm-hmm. except the people at the time interpreted them as airships. And there were airships that in very primitive ways could maneuver, although they didn't really with a few exceptions, like maybe there was one that had an electric motor that could, you know, was light enough to put aboard so they could propel. In other words, they were starting to move beyond just the hot air balloon that is carried along by the wind, right?
Yeah, right.
Maneuverable. And so if this airship really existed, then it was several decades ahead of its time. And then what happened to this thing? And yet, and some of the, you got the yellow journalism of the day, which are just obviously making up some of these stories, but the initial sightings, and then the fact that they would every few weeks or a month would go by, and then suddenly in a completely different state, somebody would see them, and then more people would see it, often described as a cigar shape. But if you read the work, the research of Jacques Vallée, I believe is his name, and then other people have cited him more recently, a lot of interesting work looking at fairies. I imagine you've heard of the fair folk, the that actually modern UFO sightings are really just a continuation of the fairy phenomenon, with just a completely with a new worldview providing a new interpretation. But it's really the same phenomenon, and I'm completely convinced by that
Yeah,
claim.
interesting.
But so these airships, so it'd be fun to pull a Tim Powers and try to find out some other things that were going on and weave this complicated explanation for where these airships actually came from. But I don't know, that the problem is that takes a lot of work. And if you want to make the claim that there's no proof that it didn't happen that way, then you've got to just, you would have to read every single stinking newspaper clipping. And
Yep. Every book
Tim
about
Powers
it,
is a superhuman. I don't think I can do that.
That
So
man probably knows more about very specific niche things than anybody else on the planet, you know? Oh, yeah, the amount of research, and going back to well, that all sounds really interesting, by the way. That all sounds really cool. But going back to like Aleister Crowley, I think Gene Wolfe, going back to both of them, Gene Wolfe said the only type of person he fears are diabolists, and I think he might have been referencing Aleister Crowley, but he's like the only people that make him really uncomfortable and nervous are basically Satanists, and like occultists and stuff. And another author that I like is Manly Wade Wellman. And he based his villain in the John Thunstone stories off of Aleister Crowley. And his name's Rowley Thorne. And like, because Manly Webb, he did not like Aleister Crowley. Same with like Arthur Machen. He did not, neither of those guys liked him at all. But Aleister Crowley liked both
It was one
of.
of the few people who could dance up to the edge of the cliff and not fall off,
Yeah, well,
as
yeah.
far as I can tell. But he was dancing. But yeah, that's interesting about Manly Wade Wellman. I believe, if I remember correctly, I think we ran one of his stories in the Protecting Project Pulp podcast.
Okay.
Oh, which I read it and picked it out. That's interesting, because what was Wellman's religious beliefs then?
He was Episcopalian.
Okay, so a practicing Christian then.
I think he was practicing.
I did not know that. That's
Yeah,
interesting.
he I'm gonna do an episode on him as soon as Hafner Press they have the complete Silver John the Balladeer stories. And I ordered one back in 2021, and they finally have them. And I don't know when I'm going to get my copy, but it's going to happen hopefully this year. And so when that happens, I'll have an episode on him. Yeah, it's taken a while. The owner of Hofner, I think it's just him who does it. He had like surgery and all these like during COVID. He was trying to get research from Brown University, which is where all the Wellman stuff is kept, and they were locked down for COVID, and he couldn't get access to certain things. And then there was like,
I see.
just stuff with the printer, and it just took a long time. But I believe, was a practicing Episcopalian, and he was a big fan of Chesterton, I believe. And his main character, the main villain in the John Thunstone stories, was based off of Aleister Crowley, and Crowley liked those stories, but Wellman did not like him, which is why he made him a villain, right? And so it's just
Well, I
funny
mean,
to
you
me. I don't know.
mentioned Chesterton. So, in our list of Christian speculative fiction masterpieces, we really should add The Man Who Was Thursday,
yeah.
which is one of the weirdest books,
yep,
or at least unique. I shouldn't say most unique. It was one of the most creative, definitely sui generis. And I'm a huge, huge fan of that book. Any of your listeners who has not yet read Man Who Was Thursday has got to stop listening to this podcast right now and download them. And, you know, so that, yeah. So those are the kinds of things I'm thinking about. I am wrapping up a YA trilogy now, which consumed like 4 years of my life.
Yeah.
And so I'm at the point now where I have not been in years where I'm asking myself, what's going to be my next novel? And I don't know yet. So
gotcha. You have another one that I have on my shelf over there. Ronald Reagan's Brilliant Bullet. Is that right?
Right.
So it's starring Ronald Reagan as the main character.
Yes. Yes. And this is the Cold War, but with Ronald Reagan and a jetpack.
Yes.
So he's doing battle in a very personal way, or preparing to do battle against the Soviet missiles, which are aimed at the United States. Another one where you are not supposed to believe for 1 minute that anything on the page is possible.
Well, I think I flipped through it, and I think there was a few lines between St. John Paul II and Cardinal Ratzinger back in the 80s. I think they feature in the book, from what I was flipping through.
Yes, Ronald Reagan asks Billy Graham to as his sends him as his personal emissary to the Vatican for a strategy meeting.
Awesome.
And to get some, you know, there's some weird spiritual stuff going on, so he wants advice from the Pope. So
yeah,
of course Billy Graham can't go up to the portal of St. Peter's and knock, you know. So instead he uses a glider to land on the top of the dome, and then he uses a bungee cord to lower himself down onto the roof of the Bernini, what is that, canopy? What do they call that huge bronze the little house over the high altar there?
I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah. You're exposing my ignorance here, and I'm the Catholic. So
Bernini is the sculptor.
That sounds right. Yeah. But I don't know the name. I'll find that out, I suppose.
Yeah. It has these complex sort of spiral columns.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I can picture it. Yeah.
With Renaissance technology
mm-hmm.
to get right. And I would love to know, you know, it's probably some kind of geometric contraption to cut, you know, into the clay model. Or I'm just speculating, but how he sculpted those is without a CAD program running on his laptop. It's just amazing.
Right. Well, this is a really off topic now, but like there's a
yes it is.
a set of stairs in I think it's New Mexico that were said to be built by Saint Joseph. So there's these nuns who were down there, and to get to the choir loft, there was a ladder, right, in their little chapel, but it's undignified, right, for nuns with skirts to go up a ladder. They wanted stairs, but they didn't know who could build the stairs for them. So they prayed to St. Joseph, like they did this a novena. And on the ninth day, a man showed up. They didn't know who he was, and he built these stairs. And
a carpenter,
and he built these stairs. And these are real, like you can go and see them. And there's no like central support for the stairs. They all just, it's all kind of like self-supporting. And it took like, I don't know, I can't remember how old they are, but it took like over 50 years or more for like master carpenters to figure out exactly how this guy built these stairs, because they're kind of like a carpentry like marvel, you know. They're completely mysterious.
Kind of thing where it can't, no part of it can hold up unless it's all assembled or something like that.
I don't know. It's really cool, because like they and they finally figured out how this guy did it, you know. It like you get the wood wet, you like soak it, and then you can bend it into shape and that sort of stuff. But like
wow.
Yeah, it's you know, pretty cool. So that's what that reminded me of. Anyway, that was very, very off topic, but I think it sounds like we're wrapping up. So I have one more question. And as you alluded to earlier, you know what's coming. So this show is called I Might Believe in Fairies, because I am personally, maybe less so now, agnostic to the idea that there are creatures out there that are fairies, that they actually exist. So I'm going to ask you, Frederick Gero Heimbach, do you believe in fairies?
I do, yes.
All right.
To avoid redundancy with some of the very thoughtful answers that you've had on your show that I've listened to, I want to explore one particular angle, which is the overwhelming diversity in our biological world, in our physical universe here on Earth. When you look at all the things that God has, all the creatures and all the plants that God has created, and, you know, is that, did he do that just to teach us some kind of moral lesson? If you recall from, if you've read Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis's autobiography, one of the reasons he became an atheist is because he liked the idea of the wildness of the world, that it just happened by chance. And the idea that God placed that mouse that you saw scurrying across your path, that God put it there. And worse, if he had intended some kind of moral, you know, lesson, it's just there to teach us something. And it's a little weird. I don't experience that kind of horror, but I do believe that there is something gratuitous about God's creation, the complexity, the preposterous fecundity of what he's doing in the biological realm, and the fact that there are species we humans will probably never catalog, never even see, right? Because we know that the preposterous number of insect species, and we haven't, you know, we've barely touched as far as we can tell. So what's going on there? I think that God just loves to create, and that his creation glorifies him. You know, what are those duck-billed platypi doing in Australia, you know, in the mud, digging around in the mud? What are they doing? Well, they're glorifying God through their platypussiosity, you know. It's just the sheer isness of their existence. They are glorifying God. And so when you start speculating about the spiritual world, and it's a little dangerous to speculate, but I'm a very speculative person. I have an active imagination, as you've figured out by now. I doubt that the entire catalog of angels, for example, comes down to angels and archangels and seraphim and cherubim.
Right.
You know, I think that there is no reason to expect that the spiritual realm is lacking in variety and dazzling complexity, just like the biological realm.
Yeah.
So I think that there are probably angels and also fallen angels that are up to stuff that we can't even imagine, that probably has very little to do with us.
Yeah.
Now, if you believe in fairies, and what you mean is that there's this kind of third way, you know, there's angels and then there's demons and then there are these, you know, the libertarians of the heavenly realms, you know.
Oh, man, that is good. I like that.
We don't work for God and we don't work for the devil. No.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. No, and you know, what's interesting, and Tim Powers talks about this in Declare, is that the Islamic theology makes room for such creatures, which is utterly bizarre. Maybe there's some kind of subtle explanation, but to me it is theologically and philosophically incoherent.
Even in Declare,
an all-powerful creator God, and the idea that any creature could be neutral is just unthinkable to me.
Well, even in Declare, the Djinn are basically fallen angels.
They're
like that's,
demons.
Yeah.
They just haven't admitted it yet.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Right. But yeah, that's been, I like the libertarian state. The libertarian fairy hypothesis. I like that. I know that's not your position, but I think that is quite funny. It's like
or neoliberals or whatever, you know, third way
right.
liberalism or whatever annoying group that claims to be above the fray, or the moderates, you know, the
yeah
nonpartisan
type. Yeah, you know, they're the moderates
on both your houses type of people who
right.
can be.
The compromise party.
And sometimes they're principled, and sometimes they just want to be the last person to vote so they can get a bridge built in their district, you know. But anyway, because the fairies behave in very strange ways. And sometimes they're malevolent, and sometimes they're beneficent? Would that be the word? And sometimes they're just acting really weird, and they do things that are not necessarily good, but they don't seem to particularly care about humans.
Right.
I can believe that those are angels that have simply been assigned tasks, and that it's kind of an accident. What my story that's going to be published in Silence and Star Song, I had a little debate with my editor because it depicts an angel, or possibly more than one, making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased because he already had an opinion on the topic. He said, well, if you look in Job, darn it, I should have looked that up. The verse in Job that he cited, which hints at the possibility of angels making mistakes. So it's, I'm open. I'm not open to third way angels, but I am open to the possibility that angels are busy doing things. And sometimes humans just got mixed up. And unfortunate or just simply bizarro things happen.
Right.
And to me, but I would treat all of these sightings, I would be suspicious of any claim that rested purely on material and scientific explanations. I think there's an enormous amount of spiritual activity, for good or for ill or for crazy, behind all of the fairy sightings and the airships of 1896 and the UFOs of the modern era.
Awesome. I don't know if you heard my latest episode with Dr. Francis Young, but he actually doesn't think the UFOs are fairies because he said that fairies are like mound dwelling. Like all the stories with fairies are like they're underground, right? And these UFOs come from the sky, and it's kind of like a flipped. It's like flipped, right? So, and I was like interesting. It was an interesting, you know, critique, because I always thought like with you fairies and the UFOs, I'm like, well, they act just like fairies. Like they're just random. Like sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're not helpful, sometimes they're evil. But then he's like, well, you know, all the fairy stories have, you know, they're all from underground. They're all like chthonic, you know, beings, like ground, like underground underworld beings, and the UFOs are all coming from the sky, so that the stories don't like match completely. And I don't know if he, you know, it was very brief, like he just very briefly touched on it at the end of his book, but I had never considered it that way, like from a phenomenological perspective, you know. I don't know, but you know, fallen angels also came from the sky, so you know, like there's that like falling aspect to them. So I don't know, it's I'm open to any of that stuff, but
I cited Paul Vallée, but I'm not sure that's his name.
Jacques Vallée. Yeah, it's
Jacques Vallée. Yeah. I mean, and he may have been cherry picking the data, but there are some fairy stories where it sounds exactly like a spacecraft, but there, and then there are reports of ships, and when you get to the age of sail, then mm-hmm. suddenly people start seeing ships sailing through the sky, and you have one of them, they lowered an anchor and it got stuck like in the steeple of a church, and so some guy climbed down the rope and cut the rope and then climbed back up. And you can go to that church and see the anchor to this day.
What do you know? Remember what church that is?
Oh well, no, but you could.
We can Google it. Church, you know, anchor in the church.
Steeple. But that, you know, because every once in a while there, where's the physical evidence? Well, every once in a while there is some.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Yeah, there is sometimes physical evidence. Well, so where can people find your books? I guess we should probably, sell some books here.
They could Google my name, or you could give them, if you are very nice, you could give them some links.
I usually do, yeah.
Follow me on Twitter, at Fredosphere. But, of course. Silly me. I have a website and a blog, fheimbach.com. So that's really the place to go. And I'll be adding my YA trilogy over the next probably 4 to 5 months, one by one. And I have a third novel out. It's been out for a year, which we didn't mention, which is called Buckingham Runner, which is not speculative. It imagines a 16-year-old Prince of Wales who wants to run away. Mm-hmm. And he gets some help from his boarding school chums to do that. So they can find all of that. And my blog at fheimbach.com.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I just some housekeeping things for me. So I do have a Substack I Might Believe in Fairies, the same as the show title. And I try to keep it updated. And then I have for the patrons and for subscribers for the Substack, paid subscribers and paid patrons. My wife and I are doing this thing called a Cauldron of Story, where we're taking some Grimm's fairy tales, reading them, and then talking about them. So it actually has turned into a lot more work than we thought, because we thought, hey, we could rattle these out, pretty easy. But then I'm like, well, actually, there's a lot to these stories. So it's like it takes some time to research them, but we want to do it right. So they're fun to do. We'll try to do a number of them this year, and those are going to be for paid subscribers. And then book club, we're going to be doing Iflheim by Michael Flynn. What were the other ones? Canticle for Leibowitz, Descent into Hell by Charles Williams, and then The Broken Sword by Paul Anderson. So those four at least. So if you're a paid subscriber or patron supporter, or whatever, you can participate in those discussions, but those will be available for free to listen to. So I don't think I've ever said any of that stuff on the show before. I've been meaning to. And a new patron for the Substack, Paul Leone, thank you for your support. So that is all I have. And I'm going to try to say stuff like that more often, just so people who listen to the show are maybe not aware of the other things I've been doing. So thank you, Frederick. This has been a blast. It's been really fun. Your book, The Devil's Dictum, is a lot of fun. And I laughed very hard, like the whole way through. Even when this stuff was grossed me out, I was like, this is pretty friggin' funny. So, thanks for coming on.
I really appreciate you, the invitation, and it's been an honor and a pleasure.
Well, that is too rich for me, man. But I thanks for coming on and for the very kind words.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.